May it please the court, Gary Nietzsche here on behalf of the appellant, Joyce O'Neill. Members of the court, the issue in this case is essentially what is the scope of consent that a driver of a vehicle has, having received permission to drive a vehicle and use it for personal use. We believe that that is what the focus of this appeal is and should be.
Can I interrupt you right there? You said where the permission was for personal use, right? And as I recall the record, there was some dispute about that because the permission initially was just to go back and forth to work. So what is the basis for your saying that we should review this matter as if the permission were for personal use?
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that there is ample factual evidence in the record, certainly much more on the appellant side than the appellee side, that this vehicle was used for personal use. The history is that this vehicle was loaned to Ms. Reeder, and that she was to use it, according to Ms. Pitts, for work. However, when the court looks at the facts, there are substantial factual inferences that are not in dispute that she used this vehicle for personal use. There were five witnesses who have been deposed, three family members.
Okay, so you're now reviewing the evidence that would support the conclusion that there was permission for personal use, and all I'm trying to find out is that something that we are reviewing here or not?
Yes, I think the court is reviewing that as part of this appeal. It was one of the arguments in our brief and one of the principal contentions that we should review, because essentially we believe that the determination of implied permission in accordance with case law is clearly a fact question for the jury.
Well, and the trial court assumed without deciding that the vehicle could be used for personal purposes. Isn't that right?
Well, I think the court, that was part of the trial court's analysis, but what the trial court then did was essentially rely upon the fact that this alleged driver, was highly intoxicated.
I know that, but that's the second issue, which is whether intoxication, either through alcohol or drugs or both, falls within the scope of that permission. But I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here. The court, what we're being asked to review is a decision by the court which assumed without deciding that the scope of the permission extended to and included personal use. Is that right?
That's correct. Regarding the issue that we believe that the court below got wrong was that the sole issue as it relates to the trial court's decision was whether or not the use of the van in a highly intoxicated state constituted a major deviation from the permission that was given to her to use the van by her employer. And we submit that there is no case that says that the intoxication issue in and of itself is what makes that determination. And
does the policy address intoxication?
As far as I know, it's not certainly in the omnibus clause of the policy, Your Honor. What the omnibus policy provision says, that any other person while using such a car, if it's within the scope of the consent of you or your spouse. And I think what State Farm is trying to argue is that obviously if Ms. Pitts were asked this question, would you let Ms. Reeder use this vehicle had you known that she was highly intoxicated? And, of course, the answer is of course not. And no one would legitimately answer that question yes and expect there to be coverage. But what occurred in this case is that she was using the vehicle to move, and it was a personal use, and that she had used the vehicle repeatedly for personal use. And the court deemed the intoxication while using the vehicle for personal use to be such a major deviation that it constituted the denial of coverage in this particular case.
Let me ask you, it seems as if this would be perhaps common's not the right word, but not an unusual set of facts, not the particular circumstances here, but the idea that I lend somebody else my car, and that person goes out and has a few drinks and gets in an accident because they're intoxicated. Is there a body of law that says, you know, permission to use somebody else's car for personal use does not include permission to use the car while you're intoxicated?
Not that there is case law that talks about whether or not, and it's in the briefs, Your Honor, the case law that talks about whether or not the deviation in terms of the intoxication is so great that it violates the minor deviation rule. We don't believe intoxication in and of itself constitutes a major deviation, as the trial court said.
Okay, but what I'm trying to get at is this. Is it the fact that there's intoxication that makes it a major deviation? Or is it the fact that there was so much intoxication in this case, together with drug use, that makes it a major deviation? Or is it sort of a black and white thing? You've got permission to use the car, you got intoxicated, that is one of five factors to consider, and we don't care whether you just had the proverbial one glass of beer or whether you were a .2, that's still just one factor.
Well, we think that the trial court put too much emphasis on the fact that she was highly intoxicated. And essentially, once they assumed that this was a minor deviation, and then they just focused primarily on the level of her intoxication, and then just made the determination that that level of intoxication in and of itself, and I think it's on page 9 of the court's decision, constituted a major deviation.
Okay, but again, what I'm trying to get at is whether there's, I know there's a case in your brief about somebody who went drinking for 8 hours and did other things. So it seems as if in that case the court was concerned about how long the person had been drinking. And it wasn't just the fact that they were intoxicated, but how extensive it was. Wouldn't that support the idea that here it wasn't, even if there was permission generally to do a little bit of drinking, this person had done a lot of drinking and drugs and therefore had gone beyond the scope of any permission?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that gets to the point that we're talking about is that Judge Cooch focused on the operation of the vehicle as opposed to the use. And I think the cases say that it's what the use is, not the operation of the vehicle.
But wait a second. If that were the case, what about the one that says, the person went drinking on an 8-hour drinking spree? That court was concerned about the drinking, not about what they were using the vehicle for.
I understand that, Your Honor. But that was I believe the facts of that case are that that person deviated from their job, went drinking, drank an excessive amount of alcohol over an extended period of time, and then a collision occurred. What the argument here is that this use, impliedly, the vehicle was regularly used for personal use. She was using it for personal use to move a, albeit legitimate, basis. In the course of that, drank and consumed alcohol and drugs, and then the incident occurred.
So, okay, well, tell me this. Are there any cases other than the one 8-hour drinking spree case that deal with the effect of intoxication on permission to use?
Not that I'm aware, Your Honor, and I think that that's one of the reasons why we're here. I do believe that, and there is a case from Kentucky that talks about the intoxication. It's Mitchell versus Allstate, where in that particular case, although there was no intoxication in that particular case, Kentucky followed the minor deviation rule and then made a determination that once there is implied permission for the basis of the minimum level of insurance, in that case it was the MRVA, in this case our financial responsibility law, that what the appropriate thing to do is to allow the adoption of the more liberal rule as opposed to the minor deviation rule as it relates to the minimum amounts of insurance.
In terms of Delaware public policy, is it the public policy of the General Assembly that a insurer cannot deny coverage for its insured simply because they drive under the influence.
And that is, there's a case called Bass versus Horizon that says that, and there are other cases that say that, and that is true. And that's the point that we're trying to make. The focus really has been of the trial court's decision, is that what you did operating the vehicle was so outrageous, it violates your right to claim coverage under the policy. But the point of it is that we shouldn't look at the egregiousness of the conduct. We should look at the use, because that's really what the focus is in the statute and in the policy. And, again, if the argument is I did not want this person to drive this vehicle while intoxicated, everyone would agree that there would be no coverage if that was the test. And just to give the court a hypothetical, let's suppose that Ms. Reeder was working at the time, had a bottle of vodka.
Before you go on, I just want to make sure that, our terminology is the same. When we talk about being intoxicated, does that include taking cocaine?
Are you
sweeping both the alcohol and the drugs under that roof?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not here to condone Ms. Reeder's conduct.
No, I'm not asking that. Just answer my question.
I think so, Your Honor.
So
by intoxicated,
we mean both under the influence of alcohol and of drugs.
I believe that that's the way Judge Cooch determined, and I think that's what we're talking about.
And that's the way you're...
Yes,
that's
sir.
The way you're using the term when you use it with us.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And just to back the hypothetical for a second, if there was a situation where Ms. Reeder was clearly working, and drank in the vehicle, and then pulled off on the side of the road, got out of the vehicle, and for whatever reason the vehicle drifted back and ran her over, State Farm would then argue that because she was, and she had the same blood alcohol and cocaine levels, that that alcohol would vitiate coverage in the case. And that is the analysis, essentially, that the court used, because the court assumed that this was a minor deviation, but because the alcohol level was so high and she was so intoxicated that there can't be coverage. And we just do not believe that that is the right analysis. The right analysis should be what is the use of the coverage of the vehicle. If you look at the use, compare that to what use is permitted by the statute and permitted by the policy, and then make a determination whether or not there's coverage.
Well, let me ask a hypothetical that's going to focus on the intoxication. Someone comes to a friend and says, my car's in the shop. It's going to be in the shop for the next 2 weeks. You've got an extra car. Can I borrow your car for 2 weeks? Yes. And then the person drives under the influence while borrowing the car, and the issue comes up, well, is there coverage under that circumstance? Is there or is there not? And why?
Well, again, I think the issue is what was the use of the vehicle covered as opposed to the intoxication? If the use of the vehicle was covered, that is, and in State Farm's own policy, this is a very broad provision. It says any person using such a car within the scope of the consent of you or your spouse. So in your hypothetical, Your Honor, if you had let that person use your car carte blanche for 2 weeks and then they got intoxicated and a collision occurred, I believe that there would be coverage as long as it was within the use. If you said, I don't want you driving between after 5 o'clock, and you wrote them a letter and it was confirmed and it was clear and the use was clearly outside of the use of the coverage, then I think that's a much harder argument for the injured party to claim that there's coverage.
What if I lend out my car and I say, listen, you can only drive it without, anytime you're not drinking. You can have it for your personal use, but you cannot drive this car if you've had any alcohol.
Then I think that's a much tougher question for an injured party to get over. And the reason why is because you have limited the use. In this case, it's not just enough to assume, as Judge Cooch did, that there's a minor deviation here. What we have here is Ms. Reeder had no driver's license. There's testimony in the record that she was buying a van. She was using it for regular use personally. And there is ample factual evidence from discussions with a coworker, Ms. Wilson, who had a vehicle too, and everyone knew it was for their personal use, and that Ms. Pitts clearly knew that she was using this vehicle for personal use, we believe. So that being said, the focus on the intoxication issue is somewhat of a red herring because the focus should be the use. And we're not trying to minimize the severity of her conduct.
So your position, if I understand it correctly, is that as long as the purpose, that is the vehicle is being used for the purpose for which permission is granted, it doesn't matter whether the permittee was intoxicated, was on drugs, or any of that. Is that right? That is, the intoxication is irrelevant.
I think it's certainly substantially less relevant than the purpose, Your Honor.
Well, that's my problem with the argument.
Okay.
You say substantially less relevant, and earlier you said that the error that Judge Cooch committed was that he gave too much weight to the intoxication. Now, either the intoxication is relevant or it's not, and if it is relevant, and we're talking about a matter of weight, then what kind of weight and what's the analysis that should have been employed here?
To answer that question, Your Honor, let me say this. If the intoxication had changed the use, then I would say the intoxication is relevant. In this case, she was still in the process of moving at the time she pulled off on the side of the road and when the incident took place. If the intoxication changed the use, then I agree that the intoxication is substantially more relevant and if the intoxication doesn't change the use.
I just want to know what you're trying to preserve by using that kind of qualifier, substantially irrelevant, too much weight. I mean, if your argument is that it's irrelevant because the use was, at the time the car was driven, it fell within the scope of the permitted use, that's one thing. But you seem to be arguing something quite different, and that is a matter of degree rather than of kind.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that for the purposes of our argument, the intoxication is irrelevant. And again, if the court looks at the case Allstate versus Nationwide.
Well, you've answered that question. Now, to go back to an earlier point that you made.
Yes, sir.
Which was that Judge Cooch gave too much weight to intoxication. What is that? How does that fit into your argument analytically?
Because the use did not change. If the intoxication had affected the implied permissive use of the vehicle, that is, using it for a personal errand, and let's assume that they stopped moving and then they went to some sort of criminal enterprise and then the accident occurred clearly.
Well, isn't your position that Judge Cooch should have given no weight, or I should say he gave exclusive weight and should have given it none rather than he should have given it less rather than more?
Yes, sir, because the use didn't change. And if the use does change, then I think the intoxication changed. And in this Allstate versus Nationwide case.
You're using up most of your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to do.
I understand that, Your Honor. I'll finish and address that in rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court. David Colley on behalf of the State Farm Appellees. I'd like to start with the minor deviation rule. It's been applied in this state for about 30 years now. It is applied by the courts in not a lot of cases, frankly. It's interesting that there are very few reported cases of this kind. But it has been applied consistently throughout. And the minor deviation rule allows the courts to have flexibility to apply and look at a number of factors. And I think that's exactly what Judge Cooch did at the Superior Court level in this case. Judge Cooch looked at factors like what was the scope of the original permission given? And there is no dispute in this case that the scope of the original permission given was of an employer to an employee to use a vehicle to drive back and forth to work because, and this is important, the employee had no other way to get to work. So this was a critical matter for the employer. And the reason
is
that the vehicle
was loaded. Is that position essential to your case here? That is, if we agree with Judge Cooch that there is or may be a material issue of fact as to whether or not the permitted use went beyond what you just described, would that make a difference?
It is one factor.
Would it make a difference to the outcome?
It would not make a difference to the outcome.
Okay.
But
perhaps this is not the way you wanted to kind of approach it, but let's talk about this as if there was permission to do anything you want. I'm letting you use my car until your car gets back from being fixed for whatever personal uses you may have, but not expressly, and you're welcome to go get drunk and high and go out and have an accident, but an open-ended personal use permission. How does that, where are we at that point?
That's your garden variety friend loans a car, the hypothetical right. that Justice Ridgely raised,
right.
a good example. Because there you're talking about a relationship that's very different than this one, first of all.
But let's assume that's what we have here. Would it matter that the person who's been lent the car then consumes alcohol and narcotics and gets in an accident?
I would submit it depends where the accident occurred. It depends on what time the accident occurred. It depends on whether or not the use of the vehicle at that particular time, whether it was remote from the original purpose given.
Well, if the original purpose is personal use, whatever you need.
You still have time and distance issues, and then ultimately you have the other, what I'll call the other factors that come into play in any set of individual circumstances. And this case is a good example of why Judge Cooch correctly decided that there was a material deviation, because the circumstances of this case are so far different from that, what I'll call garden variety, here's my vehicle, you're a friend of mine, go ahead and use
but
it,
let's stay with that, because we're trying to understand the simple case before we get to the harder case. If, again, you know, following up on the hypotheticals that Justice Berger and Justice Ridgely posed to you, let's assume that the friend loans the vehicle to the driver, to the person that ends up getting injured. You know, basically, for whatever purpose the lendee wants, and then the lendee goes out and gets high and gets drunk and ends up the way this particular the way Mrs. O'Neill, is that who it was?
Reader
ended up. What is the analysis that we're supposed to employ? Or to put it differently, isn't the intoxication itself sufficient, without more, to constitute the major deviation?
I would argue that. I would argue that for any insurance carrier. But I have to be honest and say that I'm not sure that a superior court, with just that particular set of facts as they've been defined, would find that there was a material deviation.
Okay, why not? What else should be considered?
Well, in this particular case,
yes,
that we're dealing with
deciding
now?
This particular case,
sure.
Except that let's assume that there's no issue here about personal use.
Right. So we set aside the employment relationship. What we have here is, again, time and distance. We have those. And then, more importantly, this case involves, as Your Honor pointed out, not only a degree of conduct here that is far outside any contemplated use, because it involved both the ingestion of drugs as in addition to alcohol. So we're talking about a level of impairment that was, I think, quite frankly, as significant as you're going to find, as you're going to see. And then in addition to that, in this particular case, and we made this argument below, and it's interesting, Judge Cooch didn't focus that much upon this, but I would submit it's very important, is that at the end of this trip, this use, Ms. Reeder pulled this vehicle over onto the side of the
this
road.
This is your abandonment argument.
It is.
Suppose we take that out of the case. Should it matter? Is that essential to your position in terms of why we should affirm?
I don't think it's essential to my position. Because of the other factors that are unique to this case,
okay.
Unlike the garden variety case that
so
we were talking
about. So let's take
about.
It out if it isn't essential. And let's, again, assume that the range of permitted uses included any personal use. Take that out. What else besides the degree of intoxication, which, you know, I think the record shows was extreme, is relevant?
Well, If you take all those factors out, and all you're dealing with, I think I understand your question. All we're dealing with is
two factors that I took out.
Yeah. If all we're dealing with is intoxication, and that's it, and you've got someone driving around in a vehicle they've been permitted to use while they're intoxicated, I would like to think the court would find that to be a major deviation, but I don't know that a court would find that to be a major deviation.
Isn't that what Judge Cooch did?
No, Judge, I believe that what Judge Cooch did in this case, he did emphasize the intoxication, there's no question about it. But what Judge Cooch also emphasized emphatically, I would submit, was the nature of the relationship here, which was an employer-employee relationship, as opposed to the hypothetical that Justice Ridgely used, which is a friend loans a car to a friend. There's an employer-employee relationship here, and it's anticipated, contemplated, or foreseeable, if you will, by an employer, that the vehicle will be used primarily or exclusively in the service of the employer. So that made this case very different, and Judge Cooch said that in his opinion. He found that to be a very important factor. In addition to that, there were, because of that relationship, the employer-employee relationship, time and distance issues. Ms. Reeder, at the time of this accident, was on a Sunday night at close to midnight. She was far removed from any relationship to her employer or her employer's business. That was important. Those factors, time and distance, were important. And then ultimately, I think he was impressed
if we assume that there is no issue here about personal use, that is, no limitation, then what the time and distance have to do with the analysis is distinguished from intoxication, which would embrace both alcohol and drugs.
Well, I think it has nothing. I mean, at that point, if you're assuming a different scenario whereby there is unlimited use, I'm a friend, here's my car, you can borrow it for whatever, no limit, you can borrow it, you can have it. A very different scenario, then I don't think there's any difference under that scenario.
And if that's what we have, what's the result? I mean, is there some limitation on coverage because the person you lent it to goes out and gets drunk?
Your Honor, I think it comes down to the when applying the minor deviation rule.
But see, that and maybe that's I'm not articulating it well. As I understand the minor deviation rule, it is that if you've been given the vehicle for a limited purpose and then you use it for something that is a little bit beyond that limited purpose, then if it's only a minor deviation, there's still coverage.
Correct.
And then you start evaluating how far did you travel and how much difference there was between what you were doing and what you should have been doing and so on. I don't understand, at least right off the bat, how the minor deviation rule even comes into play if we assume that the friend gives a friend the use of the car for anything that person wants to use it for. Then how can you say that anything is a deviation from what the permitted uses are? But now I'm asking what happens if that friend who has unlimited purpose use, unlimited use of the car, gets intoxicated and uses the car and has an accident. Is there a basis to say that under those circumstances that person does not have coverage?
I would like to think that the court would so find.
But I need a theory. What's
I think when you're applying the minor deviation rule, and we have cited case law, although concededly the case law we cited, and you mentioned the Coronado case from the Texas Supreme Court, very similar facts to our situation. The court was concerned there about the degree of the drinking spree. It was an eight-hour drinking spree, not unlike, frankly, the circumstances in this case. But when applying the minor deviation rule, the trial court has to have the flexibility of looking at all the facts in the context of the relationship and then determining whether there was or was not a material deviation from the original permission that was granted,
a decision of law or a decision of fact?
I think both. You have to consider the facts. You have to look at the facts.
Right.
We obviously don't agree that there is a genuine material dispute in this record, but you have to look at the facts, and then in looking at the facts, you have to apply the rule itself and determine whether or not the factual deviation was a minor one or a major one. So I think the court does two things. It is a factual determination, but it is also a legal determination, as occurred in this case. Judge Cooch determined that as a legal matter, the facts confronting him in this case Very unusual facts.
Is it the circumstance here that if there had been no intoxication and the same injuries occurred, that there would be coverage?
Taking all the other factors into account, employment relationship, time and distance, and all of that?
Because Judge Kuch said it was a minor deviation, so there would be coverage.
He assumed that I don't know that he analyzed it, but he assumed for purposes of his decision that there was a dispute of fact. But taking the intoxication out, would a court find this to have been a major deviation? Probably not. Probably not. But what makes this case, again, unique, and I think what impressed him, and I would submit to the court, should impress the court, is the degree of the conduct here, the fact that there were drugs in addition to alcohol. These are all things not contemplated by the owner. And then an abandonment, essentially, of the vehicle.
But wait a second. It seems to me that any time there's an accident, something has happened that if I knew in advance before I lent this person my car, I would have said, don't do that because I don't want you to get in an accident. And there are a variety of negligent conduct that a driver can engage in that presumably the person who lent the car would never have approved of. I borrow a car and I decide to go 100 miles an hour down the road because I feel like it and get in an accident. Well, after the fact, the person who lent me the car is going to say, well, I never expected you to be driving 100 miles an hour. Is there coverage or isn't there in that case?
And actually, there's a case. It's not cited in the briefs, but there is a case that I'm well aware of where there was, for example, a high-speed chase. And in that particular – and I believe, frankly, it was a friend-of-a-friend situation. But the person then engaged in a high-speed chase with the police, and the court found that to be a material deviation because no owner could have contemplated that the permittee, the person, whoever the person was, a friend, a family member, whatever, could have contemplated that that person would engage in that kind of conduct while using the vehicle.
So what you're saying then is that the law is if somebody else uses your vehicle and does anything that's kind of outside of the scope of what a normal person would do when driving, then that's considered a major deviation, even though the lender said, take the car, you know, it's yours to use until you bring it back. No restrictions.
You have to look at, okay, under that scenario, no restrictions of any kind.
Right.
Yes, I do. I still think there's a role for application of the material deviation.
Okay, but and beyond what you think, are you saying that that's what the law is pretty uniformly, that if you go in excessive speed, if you drink too much, if I don't know what other kinds of things you could be doing that are extreme, but you are extremely reckless in the way you drive a car, that vitiates the permission to use it?
Absolutely. I do believe the case law says that, and I believe that the courts have to have the ability to look at a set of facts and determine where that line was in each case and say that that conduct is a material deviation. And I think the courts do that. I think they do that all the time. Now, intoxication is an important factor,
well, I would
along with the other factors.
I would appreciate your submitting afterwards the case where you say there was excessive speed and that was the only problem with it, if you will, and the court said that was a major deviation.
I will do that.
Thank you.
Addressing this in the context of a bailment, is there an implied condition of the bailment, of every bailment, that the bailee is not going to engage in reckless conduct? And if that's the case, would we say there's an implied condition that there's not going to be grossly negligent conduct? But everyone has to accept that there may be negligence because that's the way life is? Is that one way to analyze this?
It is one way to analyze it. I don't know that every simply negligent situation doesn't result under the circumstances, the combination of facts, in a finding of material deviation, but certainly reckless or grossly negligent conduct would be the kind of thing that the court would look at and say that's a material deviation. So I think that
if you included negligent conduct, the coverage would be illusory because there's
and not of course, but not in every case. Not in every case. You could have a fact situation where, let's say in this case, I don't view it that way, but let's say in this case, Ms. Reeder's decision or process of pulling this vehicle over onto the shoulder of an interstate highway at night in the dark and getting out of the vehicle while it's running and apparently still in gear and walks away from it, let's say that's just simply purely negligent. It's a material deviation. It's a material deviation from the scope of permission that was granted under any fact scenario that we're applying in this particular case.
Well, what is the scope of permission when the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
It's our position that the scope was for Ms. Reeder to use her employer's vehicle to drive back and forth to work, and Ms. Pitts did say, if you need to stop at the grocery store, do that on your way home.
Meaning, and does the case rise or fall on that characterization of the case?
I don't.
Because that's not what the trial court did. Would you agree?
I agree. The trial court did not.
You haven't cross-appealed.
No, Judge Kruse decided the case on the basis of the material deviation.
Okay. But more than that, he decided the case assuming, again, without deciding, that the scope of permitted use included personal use beyond just stopping at the grocery store to and from work.
He said some personal use, but he did not decide that. But to answer Justice, if I may, to answer Justice Ridgely's question, we cited in our brief why we believe that the disputed facts that the appellants have raised are either inadmissible hearsay or simply conclusory statements. And I can go through that list again. I don't know if it's necessary because it's in our briefs.
Why do you need to do that? I mean, it sounds like you're fighting the factual assumption of the decision that you're here to defend. And I need to know, are you for it or against it?
We do not believe that there is a genuine material dispute of fact in the record as to permission.
Yeah, but why do we have to go through and parse through all that if your position is that we can affirm on the basis of the decision as it was actually written rather than having to change it?
I misunderstood your question. I do believe that you can affirm on the basis of the decision from Judge Kuch.
Right, so whether or not you agree with the trial court's assumption that the scope of the permitted personal use was greater than you would like it to be, that particular wrinkle is not material.
Agreed. We responded because it was an argument that was made and because we thought, frankly, the court may have some questions about that.
Now, in this, there's no Delaware Supreme Court precedent on the minor deviation rule. And there is an alternative rule in other states, right, the initial permission rule?
It is.
And if we were writing on a clean slate, which we apparently are, why should we pick the minor deviation rule over the other?
I see that my time is up, but I'll answer that question. There are a lot of reasons I would submit not to adopt the implied permission rule, the most significant of which, number one, I think the treatises are clear that the minor deviation rule is by far the one adopted by courts around the country. It is increasingly used and the one of choice. The implied permission rule has essentially no limits, very little limits, in terms of where we get at the end of the day with this analysis. For example, under the implied permission rule, once permission is granted at the outset, for whatever purpose, no matter what limitations were placed, once permission is given, then any use after that, any use of the vehicle, falls within the coverage. And even more troubling, I would submit, is in second permittee and third permittee situations, which do occur. Second permittee cases occur a lot. Under the initial permission rule, that vehicle could be given to a second permittee or even to a third permittee, not even known to the owner. And that use under the implied permission rule is covered because there had been an initial permission given to the first permittee. So the breadth of that rule, and I think the reason why it's such a minority rule and has been accepted by so few states, is that it just, frankly, is too broad. And the minor deviation rule allows more flexibility in considering factors. And frankly, as I submitted in my brief, gives the courts a role in determining what is or is not permitted use.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I just want to make four very quick points. The first is, as I wanted to do on my initial presentation to you, is the Allstate versus Nationwide case. The difference between Judge Cooch's analysis and that decision is that the ruling was concerned with the use of the coverage as it's permitted, as is covered, as long as the use is permitted, and it's immaterial how the vehicle was operated. And that's the difference here. Their dispute is how the vehicle was operated as opposed to the use. And if you look at the use of it, we believe that there is coverage in this particular case. The second brief contention is there was no abandonment here. There's no evidence of that. We don't even know who was actually operating the vehicle at the time Ms. Reeder was ran over, whether it was drifting back on her own. The state police don't know whether Mr. Cutler ran around and tried to get in the vehicle and hit the gas by mistake. No one knows because he was .26. But to answer the question that the courts had about what Judge Cooch's issue was.
Let me interrupt and instead ask you about opposing counsel is suggesting that it is a deviation from the permitted use, even if it's a general all-purpose permitted use. It is a deviation from that use if the driver then engages in extremely negligent conduct, either by speeding or by being drunk or that sort of thing. Do you dispute that as a matter of the way the law has been applied?
I believe so, Your Honor, because, again, we have case law that says, Bass versus Horizon, that intoxication in and of itself doesn't violate your right to coverage. And that is clear. And clearly, on page 2 of Judge Cooch's decision, he says the sole issue in this before the court is whether or not, as a matter of law, the use of the van at the time of the accident in a highly intoxicated state is a major deviation from the permission given, and that is the only issue that he focused on.
Thank you.
May I ask just one question? The minor deviation rule or the initial permission rule?
Yes, sir.
You would advocate that we adopt, as of the Supreme Court, the minor deviation rule?
Except as it relates to, like the court did in that Kentucky case, as it relates to the minimum limits. In this particular case, Ms. Reeder's family still hasn't been afforded the right to pay for her funeral. And as it relates to the minimum insurance levels, the financial responsibility laws, the appropriate rule should be the more liberal rule, because that's what they did in that Kentucky case. And once there's implied permission, you should adopt the more liberal rule as it relates to the minimum financial responsibility law for the liability coverage and the no-fault PIP coverage.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll adjourn for today.